The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight what I thought of talking about is a topic that the Buddha seemed to think was pretty important. The theme is wise effort. And it's a topic that is found in a lot of different places in the Buddha's teaching. He was very fond of lists, the Buddha, and wise effort or effort, this exploration around effort, is found in almost more lists than any other topic, except possibly mindfulness. So I just thought I'd explore that with you tonight, and just to think a little bit first about this term wise effort. This is the framing as it is found in the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha's basic guidance for us, his instructions for us about how to live a life that will bring us more ease and peace. How do we live a life that will make us happier, more truly happy, not happier in the way that we kind of habitually think we'll be happy by getting things and getting rid of things, getting things we like, having things we like, getting rid of things we don't like. That's our kind of habitual way of thinking happiness is going to be found. But the Buddha actually, in his own exploration, in his own path of looking for happiness, found that that very way, that habitual way that humans try to find happiness. This is not just our culture. You know, it seems to be pretty rampant in our culture, especially, you know, if you look at commercials on television that, you know, they show you, if you have this beautiful shining hair, you'll be happy. You have this kind of beer, you'll be happy. I mean, it's like we are really encouraging that kind of mentality, but it's just the kind of mentality that humans have everywhere, that this short-sighted idea that if I get what I want, I'll be happy. If I get rid of what I don't want, I'll be happy. And the Buddha, in looking at that, basically discovered that that very process of getting what I want, trying to hold on to it, trying to create a situation in which I only have the things that I like and only get rid of the things that I don't like, creates a kind of a tension in our minds, in that it's not possible to create a situation in which we have only what we like and not what we don't like. And so it sets us up in a way to feel like we're failing when it's not happening. And that very tension is leading us right away from a deeper kind of happiness, a truer kind of happiness. And so the Buddha found his own way towards peace, ease of mind, and he articulated it for us in this set of practices in the Eightfold Path. I'll just name them. I won't go into them now, but I'll just name them. And they are like wise understanding, understanding what it means to move towards true happiness, wise intention, having the intention to move in that direction, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, ethical considerations that will help us to be more truly happy. And then wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, which are the practices of meditation, basically. Wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration come together to help us to explore and understand in our own minds the patterns, the habits of mind that tend to kind of steer us in the wrong direction, and to help us move in this more skillful direction. The Buddha suggested starting that path of meditation practice with wise effort. And so this points to, it's not just about doing anything, but about doing this meditation, doing this practice in a helpful way, in a wise way. So this is about looking at how we practice. And the Buddha had some specific things to suggest for us about how we practice, what is helpful for us to practice with. Now, this wise effort, and also in the Pali for this, is often translated as right effort. And sometimes the way we think about what right is, we maybe misunderstand what this is saying. And so another way to think about the use of right in terms of right effort is that the Buddha basically says, okay, if you have a map here, there's a map of various ways that we can go in our life. And in this direction lies peace and happiness. And in this direction lies struggle and suffering. Then he found a map, he found a pathway that will lead us towards peace and ease in our lives. And so it's kind of like if you're talking to somebody about a map and you say, well, don't go that way, that's the wrong way. Go that way, that'll get you there. That's the right way. So in that way is what is meant by right effort. It's not so much about a moral judgment or a sense of good or bad. It's more of a practical thing. If you want to have peace and ease in your life, this is the way to go about it. And the Buddha kind of laid it out for us in that way. And so he kind of basically said there's kind of a set of things we can do that will help us to move in that direction towards ease and peace. And there's a set of things that we habitually do that tends to take us towards struggle, towards suffering, towards distress, towards dissatisfaction, towards unease, towards unhappiness, towards reactivity. All of the kind of ways we get caught and struggle in our lives. He says there's a whole set of things that we habitually do that are not helpful, that lead us in that direction. And a whole set of other things that we can engage in that will lead us away from that struggle, towards ease and peace. And so the terming of this, these two different directions, is one direction is called skillful or wholesome, the other direction unskillful or unwholesome. And again, it's not so much about this kind of external morality, but it is more about what's skillful in terms of what will take us to happiness. What's unskillful is what won't take us to happiness. And so we explore wise effort in these terms. Wise effort is in fact defined in terms of engaging in activities and engaging in practices that encourage the wholesome states and discourage the unwholesome ones. And he had a very simple way of making this division of what's helpful and what's not helpful. He said, if we're acting out of greed, aversion, or hatred, or delusion, that will tend to keep us caught in this cycle of reactivity, of distress, of dissatisfaction. We may, in acting out of greed or aversion, have a few moments of ease or kind of happiness in our lives, but almost immediately, because that happiness is dependent on, with greed or aversion, our happiness is dependent on constructing something in the world or some state of being. And it's like, it's that thing that we think is making us happy. So having something or being recognized by somebody or having the relationship that we want or a job that we want, that we think that our happiness is dependent on having these things or getting rid of things that are not so helpful or not so happy for us, not so pleasant for us. And so that that mode of constructing and moving in that direction keeps us caught in that cycle, because once we get something that we like or get rid of something that we don't like, we all know, actually, at a very kind of intuitive level, we know that those things aren't permanent, that there's, you know, that we have to keep working in order to keep our life in order in that way. And so we're caught in a kind of a cycle of doing in order to keep our lives at a state of marginal happiness. Now, the Buddha does say there is happiness that can be found in that way. You get what you want, there is a kind of happiness. Yes, there is a kind of happiness there. But how long does that happiness last before we start, before it either goes away or we get bored with it or it's not so interesting anymore? And then it's like, well, when was I last the most happy? Well, when I got something. So what can I want in order to get something so that I feel that way again? So we end up caught on this cycle of trying to get something or get rid of something in order to get that moment of feeling okay about ourselves, which lasts for a few moments, maybe as long as a day or a week, but then tends to fade. And so the acting out of greed, out of aversion, out of delusion, we do have little fleeting moments of happiness, but essentially the delusion of this path of acting or trying to find happiness based on getting what I want or getting rid of what I don't want, the delusion is that that's the best it can be, that's the happiness that is the best that we can have. And so the Buddha said, well, actually, he discovered, and it's not actually obvious, but he discovered a different way. By not grasping, he framed it in the negative. He said, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that's the way towards true happiness, true peace. Essentially letting go of the need to construct, to hold. Not that we don't do things in our lives, not that we don't engage in having a job and having a house or, you know, buying food and having relationships. Not that we don't do that. It's not that we, like, put ourselves in a cave. But that we recognize that the way that we've been going about happiness results in a very fleeting kind of happiness. And that there's a deeper kind of happiness that can be found by being at ease with things as they are, by not demanding or expecting things to be just the way we want them to be. And this is this pathway of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So the Buddha suggested that we engage in actions that support this. So he had some specific actual physical actions that we should avoid or engage in that will help us with this, these two categories. And he basically said, you know, avoid killing things, avoid taking what's not given, avoid engaging in a sexuality that causes harm, basically a non-harming mode. He said, if we are causing harm in the world, generally causing harm is coming out of this mental pattern of wanting something, wanting things to be my way. And so he encouraged us to avoid actions that create harm in the world. Avoid false speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, idle chatter. So he had some specific things that he encouraged us to avoid. And kind of on the flip side, things that he encouraged us to, he said that wise action is refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from causing harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech, refraining from idle chatter, refraining from divisive speech and harsh speech. But those actions in the world will help us to begin to step on the path towards the pathway towards ease, towards peace. But wise effort is primarily about, not so much about the physical actions in the world. The physical actions in the world we can engage in, we can be engaged in not taking things in the world. We can avoid killing things. We can avoid stealing things. We can avoid harming with our speech and with our actions, and yet still be all caught up and bound in our minds and frustrated and angry and confused, and still be not engaging in those actions. And so the engaging in that wise action is the first step on the pathway towards ease and peace. And yet the deeper movement towards ease and peace comes as we start to actually look at our minds. We start to look at the way our minds do this struggle, do this wanting things to be the way we want them to be, wanting to get rid of things, wanting to hold on. So we start to look at wise effort is about beginning to look at these different states of mind. And the Buddha suggested that we encourage and cultivate and maintain states of mind that are based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. And he suggested that we avoid and abandon states that are based in greed, aversion, and delusion. So, you know, states that are based in greed, aversion, and delusion, this is the whole host of what we could call afflictive emotions. Anger, confusion, frustration, irritation, rage, pride, greed, arrogance, boredom even is in that category. Just all of these emotions, these states of mind where we get to a place where it feels like, I don't like things the way they are. Actually, I don't like things the way they are is usually what rebounds on our mind and creates these emotions. You know, this thing is here and I don't like it and I want to get rid of it and I get angry about it or frustrated about it or irritated about it, thinking I have to do something about it, fix it, change it, and basically unhappy about the way things are because it's not the way I want it to be. So this is that range of unhelpful emotions. They're all rooted in this kind of greed, aversion, and delusion. They all come back to that, one of those three states. And the Buddha suggested that we, on the other side, cultivate and encourage states that are based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. And on a positive way of framing those, that would be states like love, kindness, compassion, joy, happiness, truer kind of happiness, not our usual kind of happiness. Peace, ease, calm. Those kinds of states are what we can encourage or should look at encouraging. So this is what the Buddha laid out. He said, avoid, abandon these unwholesome, cultivate, maintain these wholesome. Well, how on earth do we go about doing that? It sounds good. Sounds good to let go of anger or, you know, not have aversion and frustration in your life. That would sound pretty good, huh? You know, it's like, yeah, if I could abandon those afflictive emotions or avoid them, that would sound pretty good. And just imagine what your life would be like if you didn't get angry, if you weren't frustrated or irritated, if you didn't feel like you had to have something. If your mind wasn't in that reactive mode, how would that be? So we have a sense, I think, of knowing that these states of mind are unpleasant and challenging for us, but we generally think when we're in one of those states of mind that what has to happen is that we need to fix something in the world so that that feeling will go away. You know, we're angry about something, or frustrated about something. And the way our mind habitually works, it says, well, in order for that frustration or anger to go away, what I have to do is fix that thing in the world. So that's our trap. That's our trap. So we're turned outwards when we have these afflictive emotions, thinking, in order to fix this emotion, in order to not be experiencing this challenging, unpleasant, difficult emotion, I have to do something out there. Or I have to make somebody else change so they're not doing something to me. How many times do we have that feeling? You know, it's like, our families, you know, our family of origin, you know, our brothers or sisters, you know, our siblings, you know, they know how to push our buttons. They know how to make us react. And it feels like, well, they're doing it to me. What I need to do is get them to stop doing that thing. Well, good luck, you know. Have you tried that? It seems that, you know, that's our strategy. That's our usual strategy, to try to fix the other person or make them not do that. So we basically are giving away our happiness to the whims of other people or to the conditions, the fluctuating conditions of the world. What the Buddha suggested, actually, in terms of what it means to avoid or abandon these unwholesome states of mind, it's not about fixing things in the world. Rather, he said, turn around 180 degrees and look at, what is it like to be a human being that's feeling that emotion? It's a paradoxical thing, in a way, this abandoning of frustrating, confusing, frustration or confusion or anger or aversion or hatred, that rather than trying to fix the world, if we turn and simply observe and know, this is what anger feels like, this is what confusion feels like, this actually takes us on the pathway towards abandoning that state. It's not intuitive, and I think this is one of the reasons it took somebody as brilliant as the Buddha to point this out to us. It's not obvious. I remember when I first learned about this, it's like, pay attention to my anger? What good is that going to do? Isn't that just going to make me more angry? But, you know, it's like I was so lost and so hooked and stuck with my anger and nothing else I had done worked. It's like, well, I might as well give this a try and see what happens. And to my surprise, that turning towards the anger began to allow it to dissipate. Part of the reason and the way that works is that when we turn towards the experience of anger, or whatever difficult state it is, whatever reactive emotion based in greed, aversion, or delusion, when we turn and look at these reactive states, we are with the experience in the present moment as opposed to reinforcing the story of what I need to do is get that person to stop doing that. What I need to do is fix the world. When we're typically in that experience, we're hooked into that belief. And being hooked into that belief and telling ourselves that story, it reinforces the emotion. And so when we turn to observe and be with the experience of being a human being in these reactive states, it kind of cuts through that habitual pattern of thinking about fixing the world. And essentially what happens in that over time, it doesn't happen immediately, but over time what begins to happen is that the very natural impermanent nature of these emotions begins to reveal itself. And so anger arises. If it's not fed, if it's not encouraged, it's kind of like every thought that we have about, well, that person shouldn't do that, and that person should not do that, and I need to fix that and change that. Every thought we have about that is like pushing the button of anger. You know, it like keeps that anger juiced. It keeps it going. And when we stop having those thoughts, when we stop pushing that button, the anger will dissipate because it's an impermanent phenomenon. And so this is one of the ways towards abandoning our difficult emotions. The other side of it, the avoiding side of it, this is kind of about looking at experience, looking at our relationship to how we do things and what happens in the world and what happens in our mind, and beginning to see that certain patterns that we engage in will tend to lead us into certain difficult states of mind. You know, you might notice, I mean, just a simple example of this kind of thing, you know, you might, if you have a family which has a variety of divisive opinions on politics. You know, going home over a family gathering, you know, and bringing up the subject of politics might create some hostility in the situation. And so, you know, one way to avoid that hostility being created is to just not go there. Don't bring up the conversation. Don't bring up the subject. That's kind of what the Buddha is talking about in terms of this avoidance. When you see that there are conditions that lead you towards these challenging states of mind, these reactive states of mind, you might see if you can avoid those conditions. So some simple things, for instance. You might notice that if you leave the house with only just enough time to get to where you're going, assuming perfect traffic, that there could be some stress and frustration as you hit a little traffic or as you hit red lights one after the other, that the condition of leaving just enough time, if traffic is perfect, creates this tension. And so a condition that you could explore to avoid that tension would be to leave earlier. So things like that. You know, we can look at what leads us down the garden path towards those frustrating, difficult, reactive emotions and begin to learn to change the conditions a little bit. Both of these, the avoiding and the abandoning, can be pretty... the avoiding in particular can be a kind of subtle. You know, you might say, okay, well, in order to avoid that reactivity in my family, I won't bring up that topic. But suppose somebody else brings it up. You know, so suppose somebody else brings it up. Then what do we do? Can we cultivate a sense of not engaging in that reactivity in our own hearts and minds? You know, can we explore what it might mean to avoid getting reactive even when the family is getting reactive? What might that be like? How might that be possible? You might explore in that situation not offering your opinion. See if you can breathe through the urge to express your opinion. Instead, just see if you can explore some relaxation. So just, you know, different ways to avoid getting caught in our habitual traps. And with the abandoning, what I described earlier, turning towards the challenging reactive emotions, that can happen as our practice gets more grounded and more settled. That is kind of where the direction our path goes, that we can recognize the arising of these difficult states and just simply know them, not get hooked by them, not get caught by the beliefs, the views, the opinions, and simply recognize, yep, anger's arising right now. This is what it's like to be angry. And that movement is not always easy or even possible at times. That requires a certain level of strength of mindfulness to be able to meet those challenging states of mind without kind of getting sucked into the rabbit hole of those states. You know, that sometimes when we try to be, okay, I'm just going to be mindful of this feeling of confusion or anxiety. I'm going to feel this anxiety. And the very feeling of the anxiety just like the mind just kind of goes, oh, I don't like this anxiety, and what am I going to do about this anxiety? And then we're pulled into the rabbit hole of anxiety. And so sometimes we see that when we try to be mindful of a reactive or difficult state, we actually end up lost in it. And if you see that happening over and over again, then the abandoning may need to take a firmer course, that you may begin to recognize, yep, I see that it's not a helpful thing to try to be attentive to that reactive emotion right now. So let me set it aside. I'm going to put my attention on something else. I'm going to go out and look at a tree, or I'm going to turn on some music and let myself be attentive to the experience of hearing right now, just to try to move our mind away from that pull into that reactivity. Sometimes that's what we have to do. And that's skillful. That's a skillful way of abandoning when we can't meet it with mindfulness. So that movement of saying, that kind of abandoning of saying, I'm going to just get caught in that if I pay attention to that, and turning towards something else, that there's an art to that. It can't be done with reactivity. It can't be done with hatred towards that state. So like, you know, if you're feeling confusion and you're just seeing that the mind is getting sucked into it, then the movement away, it has to be kind of compassion. You know, it's like, oh, mind, I see you're having a lot of trouble right now, and well, we're just going to, like, you know, it's okay if you do your thing over there. You can be as confused as you want. But what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to take a walk and I'm going to pay attention to my feet. So we just, like, you know, set it aside with as much compassion as we can connect with, so that it's not being repressed or being pushed down, but it's just like letting it hover to the side and meeting some other experience. Sometimes that takes some degree of dedication, of resolve, of determination to turn away from something that's kind of got a very sticky pull on us. It can sometimes take a lot of, you know, no, I'm just not going to go there. I'm going to put my attention elsewhere. I had, at one point, a friend of mine was caught, had some very strong pull towards depression. And on a long retreat, she began to have periods of time where the depression wasn't there. And then she began to see just the little, you know, threads of the depression coming back. And as it started to come back, some part of her just like welled up and said, no, I am not going to go there. And so there was a kind of very firm saying of no. It's kind of like you would say to a child who's getting ready to, you know, run into the road. You know, just a child that's. I remember one time I was watching a kid run down the road and getting a little too far away. And I said, stop, you know, with a kind of force to the voice. And, you know, kids learn that, you know. Kind of brought the little boy up short, and he stopped. It was out of compassion that I was using that force, because there was danger ahead. And so that's the way of that kind of firmness, is to recognize that way lies danger. And out of compassion, we are not going to go that way. So sometimes it does take some degree of firmness of the mind to do that abandoning. And that's okay. That's what's necessary sometimes. On the other side of this wise effort is that the Buddha, I mean, a lot of the times we, in looking at this path of moving away from the struggles and towards peace and ease, we see so much of how our mind gets caught that we, you know, kind of emphasize a little bit all the struggles and all the suffering and learning how to be with the difficulties. And it sometimes feels like that's all we're doing in our meditation and our mindfulness practice. It's just, okay, here's some more irritation. How can I be with that? Well, wise effort also says it's helpful to cultivate these wholesome states. It's okay to practice peace. That's what I talked about the last time I was here, practicing peace. It's okay to practice peace. It's okay to practice happiness. In fact, we want to cultivate these states. We want to encourage them. He said we should cultivate these wholesome states of love, of kindness, of generosity, of happiness, of peace, of ease, of calm. We should cultivate these states. We do this a lot in our practice, actually. You know, when we're practicing mindfulness, we are cultivating the wholesome state of mindfulness. It tends to cultivate the wholesome states of calm when we move towards just being with experience as it is, because it does tend to cut that thought cycle that loops us back to reactivity. And so the practice of mindfulness actually has a very potent effect on cultivating these beautiful states, these wholesome states. It encourages calm and ease and peace. It encourages mindfulness. Other states, other beautiful states, it actually even encourages states like love. That was surprising for me, actually. You know, I thought, you know, the cultivation of kindness and love, of loving kindness, of compassion, there are some practices taught for that are really wonderful practices to actually incline the mind towards well-wishing, to incline the mind towards friendliness and kindness. There's a practice of consciously bringing up people in our mind and then expressing a wish of happiness for them. May you be at ease. Bringing a person up in our mind, a friend. May you have joy in your life. Just wishing beautiful, you know, consciously turning our minds in that direction is a way to cultivate this quality of kindness. We can do that actively, consciously. And for some of us, I was one of them, that particular practice seemed to kind of bump right up against my very aversive tendencies. And every time I tried to do that practice, I ended up feeling like I was tied up in chains of steel. Lots of contraction, lots of tension in the body. Tension and tightness in the mind, feeling like it's just, it's like so much pain in the body and mind, I couldn't even remember what the phrases I was supposed to say. And so I let it go for quite a while. I let go of trying to do that active cultivation of loving kindness and just stuck with the metta practice. And to my surprise, as I began just being mindful of what was happening, I began to notice arising in my heart at times a feeling of love. I was on one retreat. This was like, it took me completely by surprise. I was on one retreat, and my mind kept wandering. It kept wandering out thinking about friends. I had come back from the Peace Corps a couple years earlier, and the mind kept wandering back thinking about my friends from the Peace Corps. And I kept thinking, oh, bring it back to the breath. And at some point, I thought, well, this is what's happening. The mind is doing this. Let's see what's the tone as the mind goes off thinking about these friends. And as I looked at that, as I opened to that, noticed that this friend arose in my mind, and it's like, what's the heart like right now? It was metta. It was love. It was warmth. And that was a shock to me. It's like my mind was pulled towards these wholesome states of love, and actually I was missing it because I had this agenda to come back to my breath. So I began to, through this practice of mindfulness and just being aware, what's arising right now? Oh, the mind is wandering. How is that wandering thought impacting the heart and mind? I would say roughly, I don't know if I could put a percentage on it, maybe a third of the time, maybe half the time. There were beautiful states of mind that were present when my mind wandered. And when I could let go of the thoughts, the hook to the thoughts, and feel into it, I began to understand what love was. I began to understand what compassion was. I began to understand what joy was. I remember watching a friend of mine, very first time I really understood what this quality of sympathetic joy, another one of these beautiful, wholesome qualities, I was watching a friend of mine do walking meditation. And as I watched her do walking meditation, I could see she was very mindful and very present, and there was a kind of an air around her of ease and settledness. And my heart just was very happy seeing that. I was happy for her that she was in that space. And that was a beautiful recognition of I was happy for her happiness, for her ease, for her calm and peace. That was like, that was also kind of an eye-opening thing. It's like, wow, I can be happy for someone else. It doesn't have to be something I have myself, but just happy for someone else's happiness. And again, so these beautiful qualities can be cultivated through the practice of mindfulness. And there are specific ways, specific practices that can help us to move in that direction. The practice, you know, to cultivate a generous heart, a heart that feels open and connected and wanting to share, there's a practice of giving. We can encourage actions of giving, you know. I remember at one point I decided I was going to, if I ever saw my inclination towards giving something, like if I was somewhere and I thought of somebody and thought, oh, they might like that, I decided I would act on that. And it was like, it was a little bit humbling actually to see it didn't happen that often. But when it did happen, what I watched actually was kind of, it was kind of humbling too to watch it, to watch my mind make excuses about why I shouldn't follow through on it. It's like, oh, they probably wouldn't like it anyway, or, oh, I have to mail it. How, you know, that's a problem, that's a hassle, or, you know, oh, you know, so the mind would just come up with all these things, but then I would see that. It's like, no, this is my practice. I am practicing being in this mode of giving when I see that inspiration come. So I would buy the thing, and I'd pack it and mail it off. And I'd also see the beauty of the heart that is giving. You know, the joy of thinking about it. The first time I remember doing this, I was in a museum bookstore, and I saw a little, I don't know, puzzle kind of thing that the daughter of a dear friend I thought would enjoy. And so as I bought that thing, I was thinking about her daughter playing with it, and that made me happy. You know, that was a joyful thing to think about. And as I packed it up and mailed it off, that made me happy to think that she would be receiving it soon. You know, just so there's happiness in this movement of giving. And we can pick some activities, pick some things to play with. Practices to help us cultivate this quality of generosity. So all of these wholesome qualities, there, you know, we can be playful about it if we pick one we want to explore and cultivate. Construct, create some practices around it. One thing that Gil has suggested around generosity, he said, put a $20 bill in your pocket with the intention of giving it away in the next week. And see what happens around that. Just see. You know, how does your mind reflect on it? Where does it finally decide to offer it? How does it feel to offer it when you finally decide to offer it? So we can play with practices that actually, this is wise effort. Encouraging, cultivating these wholesome states. The fourth side of wise effort is the maintaining of wholesome states when they're already here. And this one was a little confusing to me at first. I mean, it's like, why would it take work to do that, is what I thought. You know, if these wholesome states are there, I was just, you know, thinking about it. Why would it take work? to maintain happiness? Well, partly because our minds have habitual patterns that tend to take us in another direction. And partly because, you know, these states tend, they're like any other state, they're impermanent. And so it takes a kind of a refreshing of the state, a kind of a connection with. And one of the most helpful ways I found to encourage a wholesome state that's present is to be aware of it, be mindful of it. That's sometimes when these states, like when the feeling of happiness or love or generosity or kindness or compassion arises, you know, we may kind of get lost in it in a way. You know, it might be that it feels good to have those beautiful states. It feels good in the heart. And we can kind of get tied up in them or identified with them. Oh, I'm so generous, or I'm so kind. As opposed to just recognizing, this is what it's like to be a human being that feels kind. This is what it's like to feel generosity. Just being mindful of it. The mindfulness of it actually lets us experience the beauty of that emotion. When we're caught in it, identified with it, it's like there's a layer on top of it, and we don't really get to feel it. One example of this in my own practice, one time I was driving down the road, and I saw the mind spinning out into the future. It was just, it was like, I've got to do that, and I've got to do that, and I've got to tell that person that thing, and figure out that, and it was like tumbling forward really fast. And I noticed that, and it's like, whoa, wow. And I was driving, so it's like, okay, hands on the steering wheel, grounding in my body. And within like 2 seconds, it was off again. Back, okay, hands on the steering wheel, right? Present, and it was off again. And at that point, it's like, well, something else is going on here. What is going on? And I kind of opened up and said, what else is happening here? And to my utter amazement, I discovered that I was really happy. I had not seen that because the mind was so... Actually, what I saw when I recognized the happiness is that the tumbling forward was about, how can I keep this happiness going? This person has to know that, and this person has to know that. It's like planning how to keep the happiness going without even knowing I was feeling it, without even settling in and connecting and recognizing this is happiness. I was amazed that I was happy. And when I landed in that space, it grew. It got stronger. In this moment, it became a very visceral experience of being in the happiness. And it didn't need the mind tumbling forward to figure it out. In fact, the tumbling forward to figure it out was like wrapping all kinds of layers of stuff on top of the happiness and keeping me from even seeing it. So turning towards these wholesome emotions, being aware of them, helps us to cultivate them, recognize them. And so mindfulness actually is one of our greatest allies in this practice of wise effort. We can actively cultivate practices of cultivating wholesome qualities. We can actively recognize, yep, that's not so helpful, and I need to go someplace else. And the practice of mindfulness, wise mindfulness, we'll say, wise mindfulness, which is maybe we could define wise mindfulness as being a kind of attention that doesn't judge or react to what is being experienced in the present moment. With that kind of attention, it includes these various kinds of wise effort right in it. If we are mindful of our reactive emotion, we are creating the conditions for it to be abandoned. So it's on that side. It's helping us to let it go by being mindful of our reactive emotion. It's also creating the conditions in the future for it to be avoided. So that it, as we learn the letting go of anger in this moment, it kind of reduces the probability of it arising later. And so it helps on that side of avoiding and abandoning the unhelpful, the unskillful emotions. And on the other side, when we're paying attention to a reactive emotion and we're cultivating mindfulness of it, we're cultivating the wholesome quality of mindfulness. It's inclining us more towards ease and not towards the fixing and judging and comparing and changing. That fixing, judging, comparing and changing inherently has our mind kind of agitated. And so we're landing instead in just, it's like this, the mind can be much more calm. So it's encouraging calm. It also will encourage the arising or the maintaining of wholesome states when we are attentive to those. And so the wise mindfulness actually does these four right efforts. Sometimes when we talk about right effort, it sounds like we're supposed to do this and not do that. And how does mindfulness fit in there? When we talk about mindfulness, we say, can you just meet what's happening as it is, not try to fix it or change it? That very movement of not trying to fix or change is already engaged with those four right efforts. And at times, as I said a little while ago, we do have to take action. We do have to consciously say no when it's not possible to bring that simple mindfulness to our experience. And it's not always possible to do that. So we have a couple minutes. Are there any thoughts or questions or comments? How is it for you? Have you seen this kind of with mindfulness, recognizing how it helps when you be mindful of a reactive emotion, how it helps to let go? Have any of you seen that? Any of you care to share something about that? Just as an offering? Thank you.
Sometimes I when my mind starts to go off or go crazy on something, I can recognize it and I can actually, you know, say, you know, this is skillful or this isn't skillful what I'm doing right now. This isn't, and I can actually stop that and
yes.
Turn and do something else. It's amazing. When
yes.
I find it's amazing. But I mean, a lot of times I don't even know I'm there, and then I just wake up in it.
And so, what happens then?
Yeah, well, same thing. I can do it. When I wake up in it, I can do it.
And that's the power of the waking up. That's actually something else to appreciate, the value of the waking up. You know, it's like, rather than being like, oh, I was lost for all those moments, it's like, celebrate the waking up, because it gives us that choice. It gives us that option. And just what you said about recognizing, oh, this isn't a helpful direction. Just that acknowledgement can sometimes help us to turn. Mm-hmm. So really beautiful.
And sometimes if, like, I had an IRS audit going on, which is just, like, can make me crazy. Sometimes I can do it, and sometimes I can't with something like that. And so I really do have to, at those times, I have to do something physical. I have to just go, let it go and just do something physical.
Right, and that, yes, that's that set it aside.
Right.
Yep, and that's skillful. That's what you need to do in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so learning the conditions of that. When can we meet it? And when do we have to say, ah, not now. Okay, time to take a run. Time to go to the gym. You know, just do something to help us just break the, like, change the channel. I need to change the channel right now.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you for your attention, and have a good